The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Welcome to the reading of National Geographic. I'm Susan Tucker for the Virginia Voice, and I'll begin by reading articles from National Geographic online. The History Magazine, Poisoned, Shot, or Drowned. Here's how Rasputin really died. On the night of December 16, 17, 1916, a murder took place at one of Russia's grandest palaces. The crime marked the culmination of an ugly, concerted campaign against both the victim and his imperial Russian patrons. It would rock the Tsarist elite at the time when World War I was ravaging Europe and Russia was inexorably sliding toward revolution. More than 100 years later, the sensationalist reporting of the murder of Grigory Rasputin, for so long erroneously portrayed as a mad monk, has persisted in distorting the truth about his close relationship with Russia's last Tsar and Tsarina, Nicholas and Alexandra. However, this lowly peasant and former horse dealer achieved such unique access to the reclusive Romanovs, alarmed the imperial inner circle who demonized Rasputin and those who followed him. From country to court. Born in 1869 to peasant farmers, Grigory Yefimovich Rasputin grew up in Potrokoskoy, an obscure village in western Siberia, some 1,600 miles from St. Petersburg. Little is known for sure about his upbringing, as records are scarce. At age 19, he married Praskova Fortunova Dubrovna, who later bore him 4 children. When he left home in 1892, his family stayed behind. Rasputin is said to have experienced a religious epiphany and spent 3 months at a monastery, though he never became an ordained priest. Instead, he wandered Russia for several years, seeking personal, spiritual enlightenment, very much in the tradition of the itinerant Russian holy man. By 1905, Rasputin had established himself in St. Petersburg as a spiritual guru and a healer at a time when interest in alternative medicine and the occult were fashionable among Russia's elite. There he gathered around himself a clique of adoring, mainly female, acolytes who revered him as a man of God. But soon rumors began to circulate about Rasputin's libidinous behavior as a heavy drinker and sexual predator. Entering royal circles, Rasputin led a strange and contradictory double life. In the presence of his admirers, he cultivated a persona that was sober, wise, and advocated purity of body and mind. While away from them, Rasputin would sometimes run riot as a drunken sexual degenerate. Projecting a perpetual pious image was hard work. Rasputin was a deeply conflicted man, torn between his profound religious beliefs and a deep, rebellious compulsion to sin. The Russian public was already deeply suspicious of Rasputin when he was introduced to the Tsar and Tsarina in 1905. His reputation as a healer drew him in closer to the royal family because of the poor health of their son and heir, Tsarevich Alexei, who suffered from hemophilia. In 1908, Rasputin allegedly used his abilities to ease Alexei's suffering during a severe episode. Alexandra saw Rasputin as a healer and relied on him to help in Alexei's care. Dangerous influence. Rasputin, however, could not limit his role to health and spirituality. He also began offering political advice to both Nicholas and Alexandra. In doing so, he began making enemies for himself in the Russian aristocracy and government. Other members of the Romanov family despised Rasputin as a quack and a con man. Alexandra became estranged from her own sister, Grand Duchess Elizabeth Feodorovna, after she warned the Tsarina about Rasputin. The situation grew so dire that even Alexandra could not protect her beloved Father Grigori from the hatred of her own family and friends. In 1915, World War I was raging, and Nicholas left Russia to spend time on the Eastern Front. Lonely and distraught, Alexandra began spending more and more time in Rasputin's company. Rasputin now had his own personal chauffeur to take him out to Tverskoye Selo for private prayer meetings with the Tsarina. Gossip about their relationship took an ugly turn. Concern grew within the Romanovs that Alexandra was leading the family into disrepute. Lurid rumors flew that her relationship with Rasputin had become sexual, as pornographic images of them were circulated in St. Petersburg. Rasputin and Alexandra were talked of as dark forces who would bring Russia to ruin. Danger to Russia. Rasputin had long been the target of death threats, and soon there were open and widespread calls for his removal, by whatever means necessary. After a knife attack by a woman in June 1914 left him with a near-fatal stomach wound, he was accompanied everywhere by a police agent. No one could get close enough to kill him because Rasputin was always carefully guarded. Rasputin's alleged influence over the Tsarina generated serious concerns among several senior members of the Romanov family. They tacitly encouraged a murder plot hatched by a young, impetuous, and inexperienced 29-year-old, Prince Felix Yusupov. Born into one of Russia's wealthiest families and married to Nicholas II's niece, Irina, Yusupov considered it his patriotic duty to rid Russia of Rasputin. With Rasputin out of the picture, Yusupov hoped to restore the reputation of the Tsar, as well as help Nicholas rely more on his extended family, the nobility, and the Duma. In October 1916, Yusupov inveigled his friend, the Tsar Nicholas's cousin, 25-year-old Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich, into planning the murder with him. At the end of November, they recruited Vladimir Purishtakesh, a member of the Russian State Duma, who had already openly lambasted Rasputin. Two others were taken on to assist in the final plan: a Life Guards officer, Lieutenant Sergei Sakhotin, and a Polish doctor, Stanislav Lazovet, who was to help with administering the poison, potassium cyanide crystals, which Yusupov had obtained. Murder of the Monk. The best-known account of the events of December 16, 17, 1916 comes from Yusupov's own writings, published some 10 years after Rasputin's death. In La Fin de Rasputin, and later in his memoirs Lost Splendor that followed in the 1950s, Yusupov lays out the assassination plans from start to finish. To begin, Yusupov had already made Rasputin's acquaintance in the preceding weeks by consulting him a few times about health problems. The Yusupov family owned a palace on St. Petersburg Moika Canal, which was chosen as the location for the murder. Yusupov would invite Rasputin to the Moika to meet his wife, the beautiful Princess Irina. To conceal the visit and elude his security detail, Rasputin would arrive very late on December the 16th. Yusupov had prepared a small basement room to receive Rasputin. Dimly lit with colored lanterns and a blazing open fire, the room was richly arranged with works of art and curios, carved oak chairs, cabinets of ebony, a Persian carpet, and a white bearskin rug. The table was set with a samovar for tea, biscuits, and fancy cakes, the kind that Yusupov said Rasputin liked. Before Rasputin's arrival, Sakhotin had ground the poison into a powder that Lazarevert was said to have sprinkled inside the cakes. Yusupov had also given Pavlovich and Purkevich a potassium cyanide solution to lace Rasputin's wine. Just after midnight, Lazareva, disguised as a chauffeur, drove Yusupov to Rasputin's home at 64 Gorokhovaya Street. Rasputin's daughters recalled that he appeared in good spirits that night, but also seemed highly nervous, as though he sensed something was amiss. Rasputin had dressed up for the occasion. He wore a silk shirt embroidered with cornflowers, specially made for him by the Tsarina, velvet breeches, and polished boots. He had washed and combed his hair, and as Yusupov recalled, smelled of cheap soap. Meanwhile, Pavlovich and Purishkevich, who remained at the Moika Palace, made it appear as if a party were going on upstairs. As Rasputin, Lazarevert, and Yusupov entered the palace through a side entrance, they heard music playing on the phonograph upstairs. Two young women had also arrived. At some point, Rasputin believed the lovely Irina would come down to meet him in the basement. Irina had actually refused to be involved in the night's events and remained far away on the family estate in Crimea. Murder attempts. Yusupov offered Rasputin the cakes. At first, she refused, then reluctantly took one, then a second. Nothing happened. Yusupov could not understand why the poison had not worked. He then persuaded his guest to sample Madeira wine from his own Crimean vineyards, having managed surreptitiously to slip some poison into the glass. Rasputin drank the wine like a connoisseur, then took some more. Still, mystifyingly, the poison had no effect. Things continued in this way for some time. Rasputin prevailed on Yusupov to entertain him with a guitar. He drank more tea. His head drooped and his eyes closed. He was tired. But yet, more than 2 hours later, the poison had not done its work. All this time, Yusupov's co-conspirators were waiting upstairs. Eventually, an increasingly frantic Yusupov went to consult with them. Purishkevich recalled Yusupov frantically telling them that the only thing that I can see of the poison is that he's constantly belching and that he dribbles a bit. The trio resolved they had no option but to shoot Rasputin. Yusupov removed a Browning pistol from his writing desk and returned to the basement, where he found Rasputin breathing heavily and complaining of a heavy head and a burning sensation in his stomach. As Rasputin stood up, Yusupov raised his pistol and fired at him, hitting him in the side of the chest. Pavlovich and Purkevich rushed down to see Rasputin lying on the bearskin rug. Lazarevert declared that Rasputin was dead and the conspirators disappeared upstairs. Yusupov was uneasy and went back down to double-check the body. As he drew close, Rasputin's eyes suddenly opened wide, the green eyes of a viper, staring at me with an expression of diabolical hatred, he recalled. Suddenly, with a superhuman effort, Rasputin lunged to his feet and rushed at Yusupov with an animalistic roar, trying to grab his throat. Despite the poison and the bullet in his chest, Rasputin seemed to find enormous strength, but then crashed onto his back. Yusupov's account at this point strains credibility, ascribing demonic powers to the injured man. Utterly terrified, Yusupov rushed upstairs for help, retching with fear. Purishkevich now assumed control. Cocking his savage pistol, he went down to find that Rasputin had managed to get out through the side door into the snow-covered courtyard, staggering left in his agony. Purishkevich fired once and missed, then a second time, at a run, and again managed to miss. Despite his wound, Rasputin, crawling on his knees, reached the gate of the courtyard, where Purishkevich fired a third time and hit him in the back. He then fired a fourth and fatal shot directly into Rasputin's forehead. Pavlovich, Sukhotin, and Lazarevert then disposed of Rasputin's body. They wrapped it in a heavy cloth and tied it with a rope. They dragged it into Pavlovich's car and drove to the large Petrovsky Bridge by the Neva, where they threw the body through the broken ice. They drove home just as dawn was breaking. The fallout. Rumors of Rasputin's disappearance and probable murder began to circulate rapidly in St. Petersburg. At the Alexander Palace of Tsarskoye Selo, the Tsarina waited anxiously for news while the police initiated a search. On December the 19th, Rasputin's body, his arms frozen over his head in an eerie gesture, was found by the river police near Krestovsky Island. When the news got out, the public rejoiced on the streets, said prayers of thanks in church, and lit candles in front of the icons. Yusupov and Pavlovich were feted as national heroes. Rasputin's remains were taken in a Red Cross van to a home for army veterans. On Nicholas II's specific instructions, an autopsy was conducted on the still frozen body that evening. A doctor named Dmitry Korostovov ascertained that Rasputin had been shot three times by different caliber revolvers, once in the left side of the chest, another in the back, and the fatal shot fired at point-blank range, possibly from a .455 Webley revolver in the head. There were no traces of poison found in the body, only alcohol. For more than 100 years, Yusupov's account has been the accepted source on Rasputin's murder, though many have expressed reservations about its accuracy. One of the biggest points of contention is whether the cakes had indeed been poisoned. Not long before his death, Lazarev had second thoughts about poisoning Rasputin and had substituted something harmless for the cyanide. Yusupov's dramatic telling of the night's events, accurate or not, has become stuck in the public imagination. The aftermath. It is said that Tsarina Alexandra retrieved the embroidered shirt that Rasputin had been wearing and treasured it as a religious talisman. After the autopsy, Rasputin's body was prepared for burial and laid out with an icon from the imperial family on his breast. At midnight, on December the 21st, Rasputin's zinc coffin was taken to Alexander Park at Tsarskoye Selo, where it was secretly buried in the presence of Nicholas, Alexandra, and a few others on the site of a new chapel that was being built there. Authorities quickly caught the conspirators and placed them under house arrest. As punishment, the Tsar exiled Yusupov to a family estate in Belgorod Oblast. Grand Duke Dmitry was banished from court and sent to fight on the Persian front. Dmitry's punishment drew heated opposition from the Romanov family, but the decision probably saved his life. When the Tsarist autocracy collapsed after the February 1917 revolution, Dmitry was a long way from danger. The conspirators claimed to have killed Rasputin to save the Russian throne, but it seems their actions did little to help the monarchy in the long term. Tensions caused by World War I and domestic turmoil boiled over a few months after Rasputin's death. After the revolution of 1917, Nicholas II abdicated, ending three centuries of Romanov rule. Nicholas, Alexandra, and their children were imprisoned by Russia's provisional government and exiled, first to Siberia and then to Yekaterinburg. The entire family would be murdered there in July of 1918. In early March 1917, Rasputin's resting place was discovered at Tsarskoye Selo. The provisional government feared his grave could serve as a potential pilgrimage site and ordered it destroyed. The coffin was dug up in secret, and Rasputin's remains were burned. For the Russian public, fueled by their irrational and deep-seated hatred of him, it was a fitting end. Science, mind, body, wonder. More adults under age 50 are getting shingles. Why? The infection, which can trigger a painful, blistering rash, is caused by the chickenpox virus. Here's how you can get it and how to prevent it. Not long ago, Justin Bieber, 29, made headlines when he canceled an international tour after part of his face became paralyzed due to complications from shingles, an infection caused by the chickenpox virus, and thought to affect only older adults. But the truth is, anyone can get shingles, and there's some evidence that cases are increasing among adults under age 50. Between 1998 and 2019, the incidence of shingles increased across all ages, but particularly among those in their 30s and 40s, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The illness can trigger a painful, blistering rash, usually on one side of the face or body, along with burning or tingling sensations, headaches, chills, an upset stomach, fatigue, and weakness. A 2023 study from Duke University, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, found that cases of herpes zoster ophthalmicus, a form of shingles that affects the eye, increased at a slightly faster rate than the usual variety of shingles, the herpes zoster, between January of 2018 and December of 2021. Notably, the study found that the incidence of both forms of the illness increased significantly among people in their 30s and 40s. An earlier study focused on a cohort in Minnesota between 1945 and 2007 revealed that shingles increased more than fourfold, and the greatest relative bump was in adults younger than age 50. What's puzzling for experts is that even though there is a vaccine to prevent shingles in people 50 and older, there has been a gradual, steady increase in the incidence of shingles over many, many years, and it has generally affected all age groups, with the exception of young children, says William Schaffner, an internist and professor of preventative medicine and infectious diseases at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville. The cause of the increase remains unknown. Why adults of any age can get shingles. After someone has had chickenpox, the varicella zoster virus hides and remains dormant in certain nerves for years, sometimes decades. That's why shingles can strike at any age after someone has had chickenpox. It's so recognizable when the rash emerges. There's nothing else that looks like it, says Stuart Ray, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Sometimes people have pain before the rash erupts, and it's hard to diagnose based on just the pain. Even after the telltale rash clears up, complications can occur. The most common one is a burning sensation in nerves in the skin called postherpetic neuralgia. That can continue for months or even years. Other potential complications include bacterial skin infections and eye damage and vision changes with herpes zoster ophthalmicus. Shingles is usually treated with an antiviral medication, including acyclovir, valacyclovir, and famciclovir. These drugs can shorten the length and severity of the illness, especially when they're started within 72 hours of the rash's appearance. Some people suffer through it without treatment, which is not a good idea because we have good treatments that shorten the duration and some evidence that early treatment may reduce the risk of complications, Ray says. Reasons for the uptick. Exactly why the overall incidence of shingles has been increasing and why it's been on the rise among adults under age 50 isn't well understood. But there are hypotheses. Before the development of the varicella vaccine, most people got chickenpox in childhood. This provided immunity when they were exposed to the virus as they got older. This meant that the immune system received regular reminders to keep up defenses against chickenpox and suppress the dormant varicella virus that was hiding in their own body. But after the varicella vaccine became available in the United States in 1995, fewer children and adults were exposed to the highly contagious virus. Without this frequent exposure, which would help people maintain antibodies to the virus, the odds of varicella emerging from hibernation increased, explains Daniel M. Sullivan, staff physician in internal medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. In the effort to make our children healthier, we have unfortunately made shingles more common in young adults. Another theory involves stress, which could contribute to reactivating the varicella virus in adults. In a study in a 2021 issue of the British Journal of Dermatology, researchers followed 77,310 people in Denmark, ages 40 and older, and found that people with high levels of perceived psychological stress in daily life had an increased risk of developing shingles over a 4-year period. Meanwhile, there has been some research about whether environmental factors such as higher temperatures, higher humidity levels, or seasonal changes might play a role in shingles outbreaks, but some experts find this evidence thin. We should be careful about interpreting single studies because these correlations are not very strongly supported by the data, and there are many potential co-founders, says Ray. There are oodles of people who get shingles and can't figure out what triggered it, Schaffner says. It's not something external. It's something internal that causes this virus that was hibernating in their body to reactivate and come out as shingles. Shingles itself isn't contagious, but chickenpox is. If someone with a shingles rash, which is often brimming with fluid-filled blisters, comes into direct skin-to-skin contact with someone who has never had chickenpox or received the varicella vaccine, the exposed person can get chickenpox. People who never got chickenpox and never had the varicella vaccine should think about getting the vaccine, says Ray. After all, chickenpox can be a more severe illness in adults and can lead to complications such as pneumonia, encephalitis, and sepsis. An added benefit of getting the chickenpox vaccine, people who got the varicella vaccine have a lower risk for getting shingles than those who had chickenpox. Since the varicella vaccine became widely available, approximately 90% of children in the United States have been vaccinated against chickenpox, according to a study in a 2022 issue of the Journal of Infectious Diseases. If that trend continues, there may come a time when chickenpox is eradicated and people can't get shingles in the future, Sullivan says, but we're not there yet. In the meantime, since 2017, there has been a highly effective way to prevent shingles in adults, the Shingrix vaccine. It's a spectacularly successful vaccine, says Schaffner. Yes, it takes 2 doses, and yes, it's an algae vaccine, but that's a small price to pay for protection from shingles. The 2-dose protocol is 98% effective in protecting against shingles during the first year after vaccination, and 85% in the 3 years after that, according to the CDC. The CDC recommends people 50 and older get 2 doses of Shingrix vaccine, 2 to 6 months apart, regardless of whether they've had a shingles outbreak in the past or received the previous shingles vaccine, Zostavax, which is no longer used in the United States. In addition, the CDC recommends that people between the ages of 19 and 50 get the vaccines if they are immunocompromised. This could be because of a medical condition such as HIV, certain cancers, autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis, or an organ transplant. Or it could be because of an immunosuppressive medication they're taking, including biologics, disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, and long-term use of corticosteroid drugs. People under 50 who fall into one of these categories should talk to their doctor about getting the shingles vaccine before age 50. Schaffner says not only are they at higher risk of developing shingles, but they're also more likely to have complications, such as postherpetic neuralgia, skin infections, and eye complications from shingles. A lot of people still don't know about the shingles vaccine. I'm usually not too keen on direct-to-consumer advertising, but when it comes to the shingles vaccine, I think those TV ads are right on the mark. They're good education. And that's all the time we have this week. For the reading of articles from National Geographic, I'm Susan Tucker for the Virginia Voice.